The Mark Stein Club presents Tales for Our Time.
Well, this is Mark Stein, but this isn't quite Tales for Our Time, but rather a cavalcade of music from Tales for Our Time. Amidst the grim burdens of my daily grind, one of my favourite tasks is to pick out the intros and outros for our monthly audio serialisations of classic fiction. What kind of music goes with H.G. Wells or with Scott Fitzgerald? What tunes fit the Scarlet Pimpernel mincing about Calais or the Prisoner of Zender swashbuckling through Ruritania? It's a puzzle, and one that's always a pleasure to solve. And I never pre-announce the composer or the work, so we always get questions about it. And thus, by popular request over many months, we're going to hear a little more of that music than we'd normally get to in our opening and closing snippets. For example, we'll be right back. there are two famous Imperial marches. One is by John Williams for Star Wars, and the other is my preferred choice, written by Sir Edward Elgar for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, and performed on the day itself, June 28th, 1897, at a royal garden party. And John Williams surely knew that music when he did his Star Wars variation thereof. Not all our tales are located at the height of late Victorian Empire, but a running theme of this series is the contrast between the civilizational confidence of that age and the faint-heartedness of our own. That was the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by George Hurst. It always tickles me that Elgar is best known in America for that tune you hear at every high school graduation. But oddly, they never sing the words, which are an ode to English imperialism. Wider still and wider shall thy bounds be set, God who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet. An odd sentiment for America's graduating class, for the youth of the most famous polity ever to secede from the British Empire. And in a more general sense, I'm surprised Sir Edward hasn't been deplatformed or Kate Smithed or Me Too'd or whatever they call it for those sentiments. But it is splendid and thrilling music. We will hear in this show composers from France, Russia, Germany, Denmark, Hungary, Belgium, but we will return to the composer of our Tales for Our Time signature tune, Sir Edward Elgar, before we close. Our very first Tale for Our Time was one of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's comparatively neglected non-Sherlock Holmes yarns. The Tragedy of the Korosko was a Protean tale of jihad about the ISIS of their day, the Mahdists of late 19th century Sudan. And what happens when a pleasure cruise on the Nile goes horribly wrong? Don't you find that nothing says the Nile Delta like music from Birmingham, England? This is a great piece of British light music by Albert Kettleby. He put a grave accent on the E in his surname to make himself sound more foreign and artistic. But in fact, he was a Birmingham boy from Aston, as in Aston Villa, for you footy fans, back through the generations. Kettleby was once a phenomenally famous and wealthy composer. The chain of Lyons Tea Rooms alone paid £150,000 a year to play his music over the Darjeeling and Scones. And that was a big chunk of change a century ago. This is an Englishman's idea of Egyptian exotica with two strong themes. First, the beautifully scored march with marimbas and saxophones and whatnot, and then a broad lyric romantic melody rendered vocally and orchestrally. What better for the Tragedy of the Korosko? Conan Doyle and Albert Kettleby in the mystic land of Egypt. the London Promenade Orchestra with the Ambrosian Opera Chorus and the magnificent voice of Lawrence Dale, all conducted by Alexander Farris, a delightful Ulsterman who also wrote the music for the film Georgie Girl. In the Mystic Land of Egypt is one of Albert Kettleby's Inn pieces, starting in 1914 with Inner Monastery Garden and continuing with Inner Chinese Temple Garden and Inner Persian Market. That last one had a second round of popularity in the 1940s when it became a big band favourite with arrangements by Billy May and the like. I don't suppose Mr. Kettleby was a huge fan of those, but by then his popularity was in steep decline and he was grateful for the royalties. I'll tell you someone who does remember him, though. Her Majesty the Queen, because on little Princess Elizabeth's 6th birthday, Albert Kettleby composed an intermezzo for her. I miss light orchestral music, and I think its absence from our world is a small but quantifiable civilizational loss. Kettleby wrote in the Mystic Land of Egypt in 1931, the year after Conan Doyle's death. But I think Sir Arthur would have recognised that it's the perfect accompaniment to the tragedy of the Carrasco. Baroness Orzi's Adventures of the Scarlet Pimpernel are set against the terror of revolutionary France and the heroic attempt by one English fop to staunch the tide of blood. I chose another semi-obscure composer who was very popular during those years, André Gretry, and a very brief piece of music from a popular opera of his from 1794, La Rosière Républicaine, ou La Fête de la Vertu. La Fête de la Vertu means the Feast of Virtue, and une rosière is a young woman who's been given a crown of roses because of her reputation for virtue. So it's something of an archaism in modern France, both as a word and as a basic concept. And this rosière is of supposedly a virtue républicaine. The composer was not much of a republican, but La Rosière Républicaine, premiered 2 years after the events of the Scarlet Pimpernel, was an attempt to tap into the mood of the times and retained its popularity in the ensuing decades. It's pertinent here, I think, because the Pimpernel's French wife, Marguerite, was originally a républicaine, but one whose virtue prevented her from following the cause into the bloodlust of the Reign of Terror. They seek him here, they seek him there. Those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven, is he in hell? Or is he prancing across the dance floor to the music of André Gretry? And that's all there is. Just a minute of it. Almost as if Monsieur Gretry were anticipating our need for a theme tune 2¼ centuries on. The Danse Générale from the 1794 opera La Rosière Républicaine, played by the Camera Orchestra of Berlin, conducted by Helmut Koch. John Buchan's Greenmantle is a most relevant tale from the Great War of an attempt by the Kaiser to foment jihad in the Muslim world. And the structure of the novel is really a journey ever eastward, from London to Portugal to the Netherlands to Germany and through the Balkans to Turkey and a terrific battle at Erzurum, up near the border of the Ottoman and Russian empires. I chose Mussorgsky's triumphal march, The Capture of Kars, composed in 1880 to commemorate a great victory in an earlier Russo-Turkish war, because Kars is in northeastern Turkey and about 120 miles from Erzurum, so as apt battle music goes, that's as close as we're going to get. And I've always liked the Ottoman flourishes in this piece. A great Russian victory over the Turks, The Capture of Kars. quote, triumphal march by Modest Mussorgsky. How often do you get a modest triumphal march? Claudio Abbado and the London Symphony Orchestra, terrific performance of a terrific piece, The Capture of Kars, used to conjure the capture of nearby Erzurum in our serialisation of John Buchan's Greenmantle. We're not usually that plonkingly literal about these things. I always start by looking at what was being composed at the time our tale for our time was being written, what music was in the air, and there's a reason for that. Even as a callow youth, I was always puzzled by the way a music scholar could tell you everything about the music that was being composed in, say, the 1850s, but often had no idea of or interest in the paintings of the period. Likewise, an art critic could tell you everything about the paintings being painted in the 1850s, but often had no idea about the plays or operas of the period. There's a tendency to think vertically down the development of one's area of expertise rather than horizontally across the field. And my own view is that in the heyday of our civilization, painters were very much aware of what composers were doing, and composers were very much aware of what poets were doing, and so on. Which is a rather pretentious way of explaining how I prefer, in ideal circumstances, the music for our adaptations to be more or less contemporaneous. Although, in this case, The Time Machine by H.G. Wells and the Scherzo, the third movement from Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, I ought to add a slight disclaimer. While the third movement was indeed composed a couple of years before Wells serialized his story in the New Review magazine in early 1895, Mahler's symphony didn't receive its world premiere until about 6 months later in Berlin at the end of 1895. So H.G. Wells likely never heard this music before he published his tale. I've always felt, though, that the Scherzo's spooky, unsettled quality sounds at least potentially time-travelly, like H.G. Wells's Time Machine swirling through space, deeper and deeper, to a rendezvous with the Eloi and Morlocks. Hard to Beat Sir George Sholte's classic recording from 1966 with the London Symphony Orchestra, the Scherzo from Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. I should say Gustav Mahler, because at the very same time we serialized H.G. Wells's novella, The Time Machine, I mentioned in one of my telly ventures Mahler, surname only, and I regret to say the graphics wallers put up a picture of Marley, as in Bob Marley, the Jamaican reggae colossus and ganja enthusiast. Perhaps in a refutation of my thesis of writers and musicians and painters all influencing each other, I don't know whether Jack London ever heard this next piece of music, and it wouldn't seem to be very obviously the author of White Fang's Bag, but it's absolutely perfect for London's brilliant short story To Build a Fire, the tale of a man and his dog on a chill day in the Yukon. On days that cold, you don't want to get wet in the snow, because when you get wet, you get numb. And when you get numb, you get sleepy. Even as you know, the sleep that comes will be the sleep of eternity. Many composers have written on the theme of sleep. This piece by the great Dane, Carl Nielsen, was first performed in Copenhagen in 1905, or the midway point between Jack London's first attempt at this story in 1902 and the final version published in 1908. Søvnen is Danish for sleep, but that's not what makes it apt for the story of one man trying to build a fire while he can. There is a particularly icy, glacial quality to the first half of Nielsen's Sleep. You can hear it from the very first notes. Music from Sovnen, Sleep, by Carl Nielsen. The Danish National Radio Choir and Orchestra, conducted by Leif Segerstrom. Chilly and catatonic, as I hear it. Let's warm up. The theme tune for The Prisoner of Zenda was really a sly musical joke on my part. As everyone knows, Anthony Hope's romance is the story of an English gentleman on a hiking holiday in Ruritania, who finds himself having to take the place of an absent monarch at his coronation. Half a lifetime ago, some old operetta pals in Hungary drew my attention to the big hit of the 1902 theatre season in Budapest, a new work by Jenő Huska, a second-tier operetta composer, certainly no Lehár or Kalman. Nevertheless, Prince Bob was a blockbuster account of the eponymous Bob, who's really Prince George, Prince of Wales, son of the Queen, who sneaks out of Buckingham Palace to woo a Cockney serving wench on the streets of London. In other words, it's a precise inversion of The Prisoner of Zenda. Zenda was an English story about an ordinary chap who pretends to be a Middle European heir to the throne. Prince Bob was a Middle European story about an English heir to the throne who pretends to be an ordinary chap. Because if you were a Middle European theatre-goer at the dawn of the 20th century, that was your Ruritania, England. So to pass as a humble subject of the crown, rather than be the heir to the throne, Prince George adopts the proletarian name Bob. In this guise, he meets and falls in love with sweet, impoverished Annie, the daughter of a baker who sells loaves on the curiously named London thoroughfare of Bowie Street. The Queen wants the prince to marry the Princess Victoria of Clarence, but Bob has other ideas and decides to follow his heart. It was the biggest hit Budapest had seen in 20 years. When a later Prince of Wales took up with a serving wench, or anyway with an American divorcee, the Hungarians were quick to point out the plot had been lifted from a show they'd done 30 years earlier. So here's the music we used for The Prisoner of Zenda. Prince Bob decides to sneak out onto the streets of London for some fun. Or as he sings, London bar hey, which means, in London, hey! And the great thing about this tune is that it doesn't sound in the least bit London.
London, hey, van számos utca, és minden utcán több sarok. És minden sarkon vannak házak, és minden házon ablakok. De mindegész nagy Albionban nincsen oly ablak, mint ahonnan a legszebb rózsaszál virít, a legszebb rózsaszál virít. De mindegész nagy Albionban nincs több oly ablak, mint ahonnan a legszebb rózsaszál virít. Legszebb rózsaszál virít. A Bowie Street-en, hogyha járok, a legnagyobb úr én vagyok. Megsüvegelnek utca seprők és csizmadia én a sok. Pénzem nincs, iszom hitelbe, enyém a legszebb lány szerelme. A legszebb rózsa ott virít, a legszebb rózsa ott virít. A pénzem nincs, iszom hitelbe, enyém a legszebb lány szerelme. A legszebb fi hei le chino talpan o corio cu o ciuchi a mi min delle agnutan o fordul is rabio maro kirenis deni chi pas lan ciuchi o nemkel e ciucro gondul estere
From the Hungarian operetta Prince Bob, music by Jenő Huska, libretto by Ferenc Martos and Károly Bakony, that's London Bar Hey, sung by Robert Illos Falvi, with the Hungarian Radio and Television Symphony Orchestra and Choir, conducted by János Kerekes. And that song retained its popularity all through the turbulent years of Admiral Horthy, and the half century of communism and into the modern era. My late friend, the great Magyar operetta star, Robert Rattany, was also in that production. Prince Bob. Well, long overdue for a Broadway production. One of the greatest short stories of all time is The Overcoat, published in 1842 by Gogol. And as I always used to say, if you don't know it, Google Goggle. Or if that doesn't work, Goggle Google. And after a while, I got tired of that joke and thought instead I'd narrate the story myself. It's a very artful tale, quite fantastical, and yet grounded in the realities of bureaucratic life and social order in St. Petersburg. Just as The Overcoat influenced generations of Russian writers, as Dostoevsky said, we all come out of Gogol's overcoat. So the composer Glinka was the font of Russian music and the primary influence on those who followed, including Mussorgsky, whom we heard earlier. First written as a piano piece in 1839, here's the later orchestral version of a work Gogol would surely have known. And perhaps in it, he would have heard, as I do, the sound of his protagonist, Bashmachkin, padding the wintry streets of St. Petersburg in threadbare garments. Thank you. Danka's Valse Fantasy of 1856, played by the Moscow RTV Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Fedosayev. The Island of Dr. Moreau is a provocative tale by H.G. Wells on the then very topical theme of vivisection. In trying to turn beasts into men, Dr. Moreau turns men into beasts. Brahms's song cycle of Wir Ernst Gesänge, Four Serious Songs, was written in Vienna the exact same year, 1896. And although we heard in our serialization a violin transcription of the first song, I thought we'd play the original voice and piano version, because the text is certainly relevant to H.G. Wells's tale. Den es gehet dem Menschen wie dem Vieh, or if you know your Ecclesiastes, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. Indeed, for that which befalleth man befalleth beasts on the island of Dr. Moreau.
Denn das Licht
The first of Brahms's four serious songs, a famous recording by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with Jörg Demusch on piano. One of our most popular serialisations ever was The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And yes, that's how Robert Louis Stevenson pronounced the name of his character, even if nobody else does. As I advised bewildered listeners, the trick is to imagine yourself breaking into Dr. Jekyll's laboratory, catching him mixing up the potions and demanding to know, "Jeekers, creakers, where'd you get those beakers?" Well, I didn't pick that tune for our adaptation. Instead, this work was premiered in Paris in 1885, the year before Jekyll and Hyde was published. And it's about supernatural nocturnal beings, djinns, or genies, as we say in English. Some are good, but others are malevolent, and telling one from the other can be tricky, as it is for Dr. Jekyll in trying to split the duality of his identity into separate beings. By César Franck, Les Djinns. Thank you. Vladimir Ashkenazy, unmistakably, with that super virtuosic piano part, and behind him the Deutsche Symphony Orchestra playing Les Gines by César Franck about the demons of the night, something Dr. Jekyll comes to know of all too well. I said we'd work our way back to where we came in with Elgar's Imperial March for Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee of 1897. A decade and a half later, Sir Edward was asked to provide music for a masque commemorating the visit of King George V and Queen Mary to Delhi for the coronation Durbar. That's to say their crowning as Emperor and Empress of India. And midway through the masque, Elgar composed this March of the Mughal Emperors. For a while, this was popular circus music for the entry of the clowns. And it was that dim and distant memory which made me connect it with Rudyard Kipling's tale of two English chancers who fancy themselves as kings of Kafiristan. Elgar's music here is a little overripe, but who better to carry that off with utter sincerity than Leonard Bernstein?
Thank you.
from The Crown of India, composed in 1912 by Sir Edward Elgar. That's The March of the Mughal Emperors, played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. And you can hear me talking to Leonard Bernstein in a recent music special from a week or so back, in which I talked to various pop stars about some of the biggest pop hits from the 1930s to the 1990s. Lenny is the only guy to appear in that show and in this show. So if you're ever asked in a trivia competition what the connection is between Brahms and Mussorgsky on the one hand and Chuck Berry and Julio Iglesias on the other, well, it's Leonard Bernstein. We hope you like the music at Stein Online, and we hope you like our audio adventures too. So I trust you've enjoyed this selection of tunes from Tales for Our Time. And if you want to hear our next tale, which will be starting imminently, or all the tales we've talked about in this show, all you got to do is sign up for the Mark Stein Club, and you'll get access to them all. H.G. Wells, Baroness Ortsey, The Prisoner of Zenda, all of them. And our next tale will be rocketing you along from one cliffhanger ending to the next in a mere matter of days. The story continues. See you next time.
Tales for Our Time is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.